Do you have an idea for a podcast, but you don't know where to start? Maybe you're overwhelmed by all the tech or you're convinced nobody will actually listen to you. Well, I'm Shauna Game. After 9.5 years as a professional podcaster, at this show, Everyone's Talking Money, and 25 million downloads later, let me tell you the secret to a profitable podcast. It is building a solid foundation, your podcast roadmap before you launch. That's why I created the Podcaster Class, a fast-paced group cohort podcasting for profit 8-week style MBA program. The Podcaster Class is immersive, comprehensive, and insanely motivational. If you want to create a podcast, DIYing a launch is just not the way to go. In the Podcaster Class, you'll get the tools, tips, and strategies to create a podcast that resonates with listeners and one you can be proud of. Get this, 90% of podcasters never make it to episode 3. That's 2.8 million podcasters who just quit. So to be a top podcaster, you only need to publish 21 episodes, but you got to make them good. So in the Podcaster Class, I'm taking the mystery out of how to create, launch, and profit from your podcast so you can create a top 1% podcast just like this one. The May cohort is now open for enrollment. Classes start May 22nd. There are only 15 spots open. You are going to learn podcasting with me and 14 other amazing people. You can learn all the details at thepodcasterclass.com. Use code podcast when you sign up for $100 off. That's thepodcasterclass.com. I'm going to be real with you. Identity theft is on the rise, and you do not want to wake up one morning and discover that your bank account has been emptied, or you're overdue on credit cards you never even applied for. We talk about this often on the podcast, but you don't realize how much of your information is available to scammers on the internet and how susceptible you and your family are to identity theft and fraud. I know, it's scary. But now you can get your data removed with Delete Me. That's why I personally choose Delete Me. Delete Me is a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential ID theft, doxing, and phishing scams. I just started using Delete Me and I got my regular personalized privacy report. I was shocked what they found and removed. It was pages of information about me that I did not want online. Here's how it works. You sign up and provide Delete Me with exactly what information you want deleted, and their experts take it from there. I cannot tell you how relieved I felt to have Delete Me. And you know, it's also a great service for your parents or grandparents to help protect them from identity theft. Delete Me is not just a one-time service. Delete Me is always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you do not want on the internet. Take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special price for my listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/ETM and use promo code ETM at checkout. The only way you get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/ETM and enter code ETM at checkout. joindeleteme.com/ETM. Go to joindeleteme.com/ETM and use code ETM for 20% off.
You know, that old advice of like just mirroring the interviewer and act like them. Like, what? No, this, can you imagine getting that advice anywhere else in your life? That's crazy. Why do we tell people to do this in interviews?
Hey, friend, Shauna here. Welcome to Everyone's Talking Money. This is a show where we discuss the complex and very sticky emotions around money, and I offer you practical personal finance tips to help you stress less and start thriving financially. I've got a question for you. Is there an art to interviewing? Well, our guest, Anna Papalia, an interview expert and author of Interviewology, the new science of interviewing, says emphatically that yes, there is. You may have seen Anna on all of the social platforms. She has a huge following, where she dishes out tips on everything you want to know about interviewing, and she's bringing them all to our conversation. What do you say when you're asked, tell me about yourself, or why do you want to work here, or everyone's favorite question, what are your salary requirements? Her answers, they might surprise you, like her favorite advice, don't get personal. We also talk about the four different interview styles so you can figure out which one you are and learn how to play to your strengths. With a layoff climate that's ever-changing in the job market these days, this episode is guaranteed to change how you think about interviewing forever. But before we get into the episode, I have another question to ask you. Have you put your name on the waitlist for the release of my signature course, Un-F Your Money? Coming in a few weeks, I am opening my course back up completely refreshed, and you will not want to miss it. It is a course that I have put over 15 years of science, of advice, of tips into to help you get in a better relationship with your money and ultimately help you be able to reach your money goals. You can get on the waitlist today at etmpod.link/moneycourse, or just head to the link in the show notes. All right, let's start talking. You know, anybody who has ever interviewed for a job, they know how scary it is. Usually, I don't know, I've only had one corporate job in my whole life. I've been an entrepreneur, but I know that your heart starts racing, you get those sweaty palms, you just feel so kind of on the spot. It's like really gut-wrenching. And then on top of it, you say, this is really interesting, you say that 90% of hiring managers aren't trained on how to interview. So we don't know what we're doing, and the person sitting across from us doesn't know what they're doing. So tell me a little bit about, like, does anybody actually know how to interview well?
Sure. I think there's a few people, especially if you're a seasoned hiring manager or if you've been an HR recruiter for a long time and you've done this quite a lot, and contingent recruiters who that's all they do day in and day out, you get pretty good at it. But the average hiring manager that hasn't been trained, that only has one or two openings a year, they're not necessarily going to be good at it because just like anything, practice makes perfect. And if you only do it a couple times a year, you're probably not going to be great at this. And we know that we are all driven by a lot of our biases in this process. And if you don't take time to train yourself and examine those ahead of an interview, you're not going to do very well and you're not going to make great decisions.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about these biases. Like, how do they show up for hiring managers? Like, how can we recognize maybe that situation is going on?
Well, hiring managers are very prone to hiring people who are like themselves. It's called the like me bias. We also have biases like thinking that if someone was successful in one endeavor, they're going to be successful at this job, right? I've seen many hiring managers look at someone's resume and say, oh, he was the quarterback of his high school football team, or he graduated from Harvard, you know, and none of those things actually really matter when it comes to whether or not you're going to be a successful software engineer, for example. So we have this tendency to look at success in separate endeavors as thinking that it correlates somehow, and it doesn't. And even more frustrating, interview performance doesn't correlate to how well you're going to be in the job. We all know this, right? You've seen people
right.
who perform beautifully in interviews and they're just terrible at jobs. So that's something too.
So you have this really robust following on social media as this interview expert. And I was telling you before we hit record, I've just been on TikTok listening to all of your different expert advice. And even though I'm not interviewing for anything, it's just like you want to know the secrets of, you know, how you do this right. But before we get to like how you do this right, I'm interested in what are we getting wrong when it comes to interviewing?
Well, it's really the premise of my entire research and what I've been doing for the last 12 years. So previously, I was a director of talent acquisition. I had all the power. I thought I knew what it took, you know, do as I say type of thing. And I started teaching at Temple University. And I was teaching for about 6 years. And I started to ask myself some deep questions. Why are some of my students really great at this? Why are the others not so great at this? Why aren't they getting what I'm teaching them? And what I discovered ultimately is I asked myself this one simple question. Do we all interview the same way? And I was like, no, definitely not. So then I thought to myself, how could I prove that? So I collected a lot of research and I thought, what if I could write an interview style assessment that determines someone's interview style? And then therefore, I can figure out what these approaches are, what these styles are, and then from there, give advice that's meaningful to people and also give hiring managers a language so we can talk about interviewing. And from there, I discovered that we don't all interview the same way. We all interview as charmers, challengers, examiners, or harmonizers. Doesn't matter if you're a job seeker or a hiring manager, your interview style doesn't change. It's just like your eye color doesn't change if you're a job seeker or a hiring manager. And this, I hope, will revolutionize how we talk about interviews, our approach, and understanding that how you answer interview questions has more to do with your interview style and less to do with how qualified you are for the job, for example.
I think it's really interesting that you can apply this sort of scientific research to interviewing, because before reading this book, I just had no idea. I thought everybody just was kind of the same way when they went into an interview. And I remember the first corporate job, really the only corporate job that I had, it was for a marketing position. And I went in and I was all prepared. And, you know, I thought I had like all the right answers to the questions. And my boss was more interested in things like what my favorite sandwich was. And we were talking about slogans of, we were working with real estate agents and different slogans that would be appropriate for them. And then we started talking about sports. And I remember my brain was like, I was in my 20s and my brain was like, what is happening? Is this an interview? Or, you know, I'm not quite sure like what universe I actually stepped into. But when I looked at your four different interview styles, I could definitely see where I'm the examiner type, where I really want to be right, right? And so I think it's fun to use these different interview styles and even look back at interviews that you've been in yourself and say, okay, how do I show up? So tell me a little bit more about the four and like what's good about them? What do we need to know? What's maybe like a blind side about them?
Well, it's really important for us to understand that neither interview style is right or wrong. There isn't one that like has a better shot at nailing the interview.
That's good to know.
Let me back up for a moment. When I created my hypothesis, when I was collecting this research, I thought, well, I'm great at interviewing and I'm going to discover that there's one great interview style. And of course, it's going to be me because I'm amazing at this. And I'm really glad that what I found was that I was dead wrong and that I was completely mistaken, which is wonderful when the research proves you wrong. What I realized is that we have these four unique styles, and I took all of my students that had gotten internship offers or jobs after graduation, and I realized that there wasn't one style that was getting all the offers. So one thing I realized in this research is that we all have an equal shot at nailing the interview. There isn't one style that's better than others. Now, from there, we have to unpack some of the nuances, right? So for charmers want to be liked in interviews. They like to make a connection. They like to tell stories. Challengers want to be respected and heard. They feel constrained by integrity, and they look at an interview like a cross-examination. Examiners look at an interview like a test that they are either going to pass or fail, that's right or wrong, and they want to be seen as qualified. In the way that their opposite, the charmer, wants to be liked, they want to be seen as, oh, that person can do the job, really qualified. And then lastly, we have the harmonizer, which is the opposite of the challenger. A harmonizer looks in an interview like a tryout for a team that they want to join. They're always considering the collective, the group, the department. They talk in terms of we and us. They don't use terms like I and me in the way a challenger does. Challengers want to be like, this is who I am, take it or leave it. And harmonizers want to be like, well, what do you guys need? I'll fit in. I'll adapt. And in that way, they're the opposite. So as you can see, as I unpack these styles, each style has strengths. And what I talk about in the book, overused strengths. I think our quote unquote weaknesses are really just our overused strengths. So that's how I like to talk about it. So charmers, if they're so interested in getting someone to like them, they may forget in a job interview to talk about what makes them qualified. They may forget to talk about like metrics and data and numbers because they're so interested in getting to know this person and getting this person to like them. And in the same way, an examiner like yourself may be so interested in being seen as qualified, they forget to showcase their whole personality. And they come across as one-dimensional, very professional, maybe even private or cold or worse, disinterested. You see, that strength stretched out can be an overused strength.
I'm curious about this too, because as you're describing these four different styles, I'm thinking about this. Do you also think that we show up in everyday life sort of the same way that we do in our interview styles? Because I can look exactly at the examiner and say, I'm pretty much this way in my everyday life. You know, something that I'm working on. But I'm curious, like, do those transfer over to just how we interact with people?
Over 86% of our respondents and over 10,000 people, I've collected research on 10,000 people, and they've taken this interview style assessment, have told us that this is how they are all the time. Now, it's that curious percentage of people that change their behavior when they get into an interview, right? So I've tested introverts that become extroverts in interviews, or vice versa, which is even more confounding to me when I meet really highly extroverted folks who become very quiet and introverted in interviews. So we know that an interview is an artificial event where someone has some power over you. What does that do to you? Do you change? You know, for a lot of people, over 86% don't. I'm a charmer in interviews. I'm a charmer in my real life. I just really want to get along and get people to like me. But for some people, that changes. For some people, you know, they're examiners in interviews, but they're more harmonizers at home. It's not a huge percentage, but that's an interesting conversation that I could literally spend the next 10 years researching. You know, why do some people not live these congruent lifestyles, right? That's congruency in psychology, you know, having, living in congruence with your thoughts or how you are. Why do you change your behavior in certain situations?
So let's say you recognize yourself as one of these four different interview styles. How do you then, going into an interview, play to the strengths of that style, but also make sure that you're not, like you're saying, overusing one of those strengths? Like, is there a way to find a middle ground?
Well, I think number one, it's figuring out first and foremost what your baseline is, right? Take our interview style assessment at my website. You can obviously read the book to learn about all four styles. I think that's the first place that helps. I always say, if you follow me on social, you've heard me say it a million times, an interview is a set of questions about you. And the better you know yourself, the better you'll do. So that's first and foremost when it comes to interviewing. Building up your self-knowledge, really getting comfortable with who you are. And then from there, the next layer is learning how to shift and adapt in those moments. It's not about memorizing the perfect answers or just telling them what they want to hear. But, you know, that old advice of like just mirroring the interviewer and act like them. Like, what? No, this, can you imagine getting that advice anywhere else in your life? That's crazy. Why do we tell people to do this in interviews?
Right.
So it's really, first step is understanding yourself. Second step would be learning how to, with your emotional intelligence, shift in those moments. And if shifting feels too much for you, then you know that your baseline is just like right here, right? Some people are more accommodating than others. Harmonizers and charmers, for example, feel freer to change up their answers or meet people where they are. They don't mind changing up their stories midway through. Examiners and challengers don't. They're more steadfast in their approach. So it really comes down to understanding who you are, feeling validated in that, and being that. We don't need you to pretend to be something that you're not. I want to empower you to be yourself.
Well, I'd love to get your advice on some of the most asked interview questions that have been sent in to me over the last few years of listeners. And I think, you know, these are things that you talk about often, but there are sort of the curious questions that we all are like, I don't know what to do about these. The first one is, and I've had a lot of people send me in emails about this one. What do you say when the interviewer asks you, tell me a little bit about yourself? Like, what sort of information should you tell them? Should you not tell them? How long should you talk about yourself? Are there any guidelines around that?
You are an examiner. You're like, what's the time frame?
I'm telling you, I'm so this type.
Okay, so I never say there's like, you know, a time, it's like 3 minutes. No. That's not the case. So don't worry about time. That's also not your job. It's the interviewer's job to manage the clock. So there are two things I always tell people. Number one, never, ever get personal. There's no reason to. This is about a job. This is not a date. So you're not going to start with, well, I'm married and I have two kids and I live in Philadelphia and my husband's a doctor. Don't do that. Please don't do that. First of all, there's so much bias that comes from that. They're going to be like, oh, she's married to a doctor. She doesn't need to work. She's got two kids. She's going to be dedicated to this job. They don't need to know any of that. Also, they can't ask you that stuff. So why are you giving them that information? That's number one. Don't get personal, ever. Unless you feel comfortable and it's valuable to the job and you feel as though that will help you get the position and you're comfortable sharing it, but even still, don't tell them. And then the way to formulate this answer, I say it all the time. I have many videos about this. It's a formula, a little bit about your past, a little bit about your present. What are you currently doing? And what do you want in the future? So past is, what did you go to college for? Did you major in this? Why are you working in this career? What are you passionate about? Presently, what qualifies you for this position? What are you currently doing in your job that would interest me as a hiring manager? Why do I care to hire you? And then future, spoiler alert, is always how you see yourself at this company and that this is the place where you want to be. Whatever you do in the interview, don't say, well, in 5 years, I hope to go back to grad school or get married. What? Why would I hire you? You know, so you have to, it's about casting your answer to be professional, how you're qualified, and where you see yourself in the context of this job and in this interview and in this company.
All right. This is already like mind blowing because I probably would have responded to that question something personal. So now I know. Okay. What about this one? What if they say, why do you want to work here? What sort of information do you give in response to that question?
So a lot of people make the mistake. So they spend a lot of their interview prep researching the company. And they spend like 80% of the time, you know, on the company's website, and they spend all this time in the interview regurgitating back to these people their company's mission and their fourth quarter numbers. Listen, I know my company's mission. I know our fourth quarter numbers. I don't need to hear you that you memorized it. No. Why do you want to work here is, what can you do for me? I'm about to stroke you a big check and I'm thinking about investing in you and paying you all this money and this salary. In the interview, you need to be telling me, why do you want to work here? Because this would be a great platform for you to do what you do. How can you help me? How can you help me with our company goals, our department goals? You know, if you are bringing a book of business into our organization or if you're bringing a skill set, that's the answer. Why do you want to work here is not, well, I need the money, or I saw that you have tuition benefits. No, 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 no. It's, what can you do for the organization?
When it comes to financial advice, you got to trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I was paying for vacations all wrong. I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? I don't know, maybe that fancy hotel upgrade that you have always been dreaming about. Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. The weather is getting warmer. I'm so excited, and it is time to say goodbye to all those jackets and sweaters and hello to the shorts and t-shirts. I wanted to update my summer workout wardrobe for the long haul without, you know, spending a fortune. Luckily, I found Quince, and I am in love. Quince is your go-to place from everything from premium European linen dresses, blouses, and shorts from $30, washable silk tops, timeless 14 karat gold jewelry, and so much more. The best part of all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes those savings on to you. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I love that. Okay, I bought the dreamiest pair of workout leggings and a bright pink workout top to match. Honestly, ladies, I gotta tell you, these leggings you need. The price cannot be beat, and I feel like a million bucks wearing this cozy workout-friendly outfit. I've worn it for like 5 days straight. Get warm weather ready with Quince. Go to quince.com/etm for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/ETM to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/ETM. Okay, listen, like many of you out there, I love Notion, our sponsor today. And I honestly use it every day for my notes and journaling. I also track our family expenses, and I manage all of our household to-dos. Notion has been such a lifesaver in helping me get a lot more organized because that's not one of my strengths, without stressing me out. Notion is a place where any team can write, plan, organize, and rediscover the joy of play. It's a workspace designed not just for making progress, but getting inspired. Notion is the AI-powered workspace that can summarize things like meeting notes and automatically generate action items and help you get answers to questions in seconds. It will honestly blow your mind. Notion is for everyone, whether you're a Fortune 500 company, you're a freelancer, you're starting a startup, or you're a student juggling classes and clubs, or you're somebody like myself that just really wants to get organized. Try Notion for free when you go to notion.com/ETM. That's all lowercase letters, notion.com/ETM. And start turning ideas into action. And when you use our link, you are supporting our show. Notion.com/ETM.
All right, Anna, it's time to play Your Relationship with Money is Game. So question number one, if you had to describe your relationship to money as a cartoon character, a movie character, or a book character, who would it be?
Sounds like one of those interview questions, like what kind of animal would you be and why? The problem I'm having answering is I'm terrible at movie characters or cartoon characters. So I'll just explain to you my relationship with money. I moved out when I was 15 and I had no money. Like really, I was so poor. I was lucky enough to have a car, but I was so poor that I would only put $1 to $4 of gas in it at a time. I slept on an air mattress and I had two milk crates that I kept my clothes in. Those are the extent of my possessions. So I've worked a lot on my relationship with money and I've had to unpack a lot of trauma around it. And for me, where I have arrived at 45 and fairly successful is money is a tool for me. So if that were whatever character that might be, whenever I get in my head about it or, you know, some old traumas might come up for me, I just imagine that money is a tool. It's not going to make, if I had a hammer, that hammer is not going to make me any happier. It'll make my life easier if I need to build something, but it's not going to make me happier. So I've tried to unpack some of the emotional trauma around money by thinking of it as this thing that helps me do things, but it's not going to make it, you know, make my life that much better or worse. I've been very, very poor and I have lots of money now. I can't say that I'm much happier now than I was when I was very poor. I have more options, but it doesn't mean that I'm magically happier. There's more problems sometimes. More money, more problems.
Take us inside. You did just a little bit, but take us inside your internal money thoughts. Is there a central theme or a thought that kind of plays on repeat for you?
That's a good question. When I think about money, is there a central theme? I do a lot of work internally on retraining my brain. Maybe it's because I'm a coach, maybe because I have done this for so long that I'm always thinking about examining my thoughts and how to recast and reframe them. When I'm a place of feeling like I'm in lack, what triggers me? How do I act afterwards? How can I do better next time? That's generally my loop that I go through. So if I feel triggered, like I go out to a nice dinner, for example, there will always be the poor little girl inside of me who's like, I can't believe you just spent $60 on sushi by yourself. Who do you think you are? Why did you do this? That's dumb. You could have just eaten cereal at home. That is a very common loop, I think, when it comes to people who grew up with nothing. Or for me, I feel very responsible to not mess this up. So that's the loop of beating myself up that I go to. And it becomes problematic and harmful when I'm supposed to be enjoying things. Like, you know, when I'm supposed to, like, you know, enjoy some of this success, I have a hard time just relaxing and enjoying something because I'm always thinking about, like, well, you know, I can't really relax too much, or I can't enjoy this too much, or, you know, you don't want to get like too comfortable. That I attribute to, well, I'm very ambitious and I'm never satisfied, but I've unpacked lately that that also could make me like crazy and I might have a heart attack in 2 years, you know? So there's that side of it.
All right. Question number three, what is a guilty money splurge that you're never giving up?
Oh, I don't think I could ever say I'd never give anything up. I am a big declutterer. I'm a big, like, I'm going to try this for a while. And I love the freedom of having options. I would say the one thing that I do every single day is I do have a nice cup of coffee every single day. Doesn't matter how poor I've been or how wealthy I am. I also own a beautiful beach house, which is my happy place. And I feel incredibly lucky to have gone from basically a homeless 15-year-old to having this incredible place that brings me so much joy. And to be so lucky that I have found a physical space that brings me joy. I don't know if I would ever say I would never give it up, but those are some things that make me so incredibly happy and satisfied.
All right. Last question. What is one money mistake that you wish you could get a do-over for?
I'll just answer it. I would caution, especially women, or anyone in any partnerships, that you need to be very careful who you partner your life with. I think it is understated. I don't think people talk about it very much. You know, I talk about, you know, salaries and work and how to negotiate and all of that piece. But, you know, the decisions you make based in love on who you're going to partner your life with, who you're going to buy houses with, you know, who you choose to marry has a greater financial impact on your life than many other decisions that you make. So I would want a do-over in that respect.
In those moments when money is just not moving as fast as your dreams, Earnin provides the financial momentum you need to keep moving forward. Earnin is an app that gives you access to your pay as you work, up to $100 per day or up to $750 per pay period. You just download the Earnin app and verify your paycheck. Then you access up to $100 a day as you work, and you can leave an optional tip. Any money you access plus tips are automatically repaid from your next paycheck. I honestly would use Earnin in lots of different ways, but what's on my mind recently is I need a night out. I need some good tacos to sip on a few virgin margaritas and celebrate you all helping this podcast earn 26 million downloads. Make Earnin a part of your financial routine and join Earnin's over 3.5 million customers who say things like, "When I think about Earnin, I think about financial stability and security. Gives me a lot of peace of mind." Download Earnin today, spelled E-A-R-N-I-N, in the Google Play or Apple App Store. When you download the Earnin app, type in "Talkin' Money" under podcast when you sign up. It will really help the show. Talkin' Money under podcast. Earnin is a financial technology company, not a bank, subject to your available earnings, daily max, pay period max, and location. See earnin.com/TOS for details. Bank products are issued by Evolve Bank & Trust, member FDIC. Okay, friend, I want to know, what are your money goals this year? Are you saving to buy a house or maybe a wedding or a dream vacation to somewhere tropical? If that's you, please, please take me with you. Or maybe you want to just grow your emergency fund because, let's be real, life is expensive. I want to make sure you reach your goals, so you need Monarch. That's why the Wall Street Journal named it the best app for growing your savings. Monarch is the top-rated, all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you a comprehensive view of all your accounts, investments, transactions, and more. You can create custom budgets, track progress towards your financial goals, and collaborate with your partner. And now, get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/ETM. Here's what I love. Monarch is the most customizable budgeting app. You can change the layout of your dashboard. You can go between light and dark mode. You can create custom budgets and notifications. You can set up all of these automatic rules for your transactions and notifications, and so much more.
Monarch is obsessed with constantly improving their product. Get this. They release updates every 2 weeks, and they even allow customers to submit suggestions, vote on requested features, and view the product roadmap. This, my friend, is totally original. Plus, they will never sell your data to third party or show you ads. I think that's really important. After trying out Monarch for myself, I understand why it is the top-rated personal finance app. And now, listeners of this show get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/ETM. That's monarchmoney.com/ETM for your extended 30-day free trial.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Okay, so let's get into money, because obviously this is a topic that a lot of people are perplexed on what to do. And I think specifically now, I know a lot of people have gotten laid off from jobs and they're really looking for another job. And so sometimes they can really undervalue what they're worth just because they want the job. But what do you say when the topic of money comes up, where either the interviewer says, hey, what's your current salary, or what are your salary requirements? Like, what information are you required to give them? And then, you know, how do you answer that, what I want for my salary question?
Well, first of all, it's important to know the laws of the state that you live in or the laws of the company that's posting the job. I know that you had Hannah on recently from Salary Transparency, and there are these moves in our local governments and our federal governments to make salary transparency a thing. And in 10 states, it's a law on the books. So you should know what the salary is, let's say, if you're applying to a job in New York, because they have to, by law, put it on the job description. In Philadelphia, for example, there's a local law where an interviewer cannot ask you what you're currently making. So I always advise people to first, number one, know your local and federal laws in, you know, when it pertains to a job search. That's number one. So you know, like, how to be prepared for this. Most often, let's say you do know the salary range and they may make you an offer. That's generally how it happens. Or they may say, what are your expectations? I always encourage people to give a range and push that conversation, and hopefully you know, get the offer. And then from there, never, ever accept a job offer on the spot. It's the worst thing that you can do for your career. You and I both know that once you get a corporate job, you're stuck in that role for 2 to 4 years. They're probably only giving you a 2 to 4% annual increase. So you're stuck at that salary. And a lot of people, they're just sick of searching for jobs. They're tired. They just feel lucky to get a job. And we know there's a lot of emotional triggers in money. So it's like they get an offer and they're just, oh, just accept, just happy to get it, fine. And then they tell themselves, well, in 6 months, they'll see how great I am and they'll give me a raise.
Not going to happen.
doesn't happen. And that's why I encourage people to do it at the beginning. You know, you need to negotiate your offers up front. Don't think that it's going to happen later. And that's the most important thing. I shout from the rooftops all the time. Anytime you get an offer, you should always say, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. I'm going to take some time to think about it. Is this negotiable?
Okay. And so then what if they say no? Then you pretty much know, okay, this is going to be your offer?
Yeah. It's great. If they say no, you know you got their best offer and you take 24 hours to think about it. If they say yes, then you have to ask them for something, more PTO, a sign-on bonus, more salary, whatever. But I want to make sure that I know I got the best offer? That's the goal of that question. Because again, you're going to be locked into the salary for 4 years.
And how do you, we talked about emotions. I talk a lot about emotions around money on this show. How do you deal with the emotional sort of roller coaster that you feel when you want to ask for more money, right? But we know psychologically there's a whole lot of junk that's going on in your brain, in your body, in your subconscious that, especially for women, you might be fighting against, like, oh, what do I deserve more? Should I say this number? Is that being too, am I asking for too much, right? There's so much gunk that goes on. How do you deal with that emotional roller coaster of being confident in asking for maybe more than you're hoping to end up with?
Take yourself out of the equation and imagine you're doing it for a friend or a loved one. We had that emotional gunk happens because of our own stuff. But if you can take yourself out of it for a moment, look at it objectively and imagine, I'm doing this for my husband or my friend. What would I do for this person? They deserve more. They deserve the best offer. So I'm going to advocate for them. And then later you can talk about, you know, and think deeply about why you wouldn't want to advocate for the best for you. And money definitely triggers feelings of worthiness for everyone. But when it comes to that moment, and if that's what you're up against, that's the closest and quickest advice I could give is remove yourself from the equation.
What about the scenario that happens a lot where you go on a job interview and you get that job, but you still maybe want to go back to your old employer and see, you know, can I leverage more salary there? Can I, like, you know, you play that a little bit of that negotiation game. How far do you take that? Like, how far do you take that process?
A counteroffer, you mean?
Yeah, a counteroffer.
So there's a lot of research done on counteroffers that if you go out and you start shopping around and you get an offer and then you bring it back, because maybe your current company is not willing to give you more money and you're like, ha, look at this, you know, I got a new offer. So a couple things could happen. They could say, okay, great, see you later, sayonara. Or they'll say, all right, we'll counter you. Well, there's a lot of research that says that people that accept counter offers only end up staying an additional 6 months at that company. Because the reasons, yeah, because the reasons that you wanted to leave are still there. And money doesn't make everything better. News alert, breaking news. Like, money doesn't make everything better. And even, you know, at work, you know, I know everyone's like, it's a hot thing on social to talk about. You know, it's all about money, underpaid. If I was paid more, it's so not true. It's not the way it works. So money's not going to immediately absolve all the problems and make it better. So yeah, some people do that. They play they do that game. But I would encourage and coach people to ask deeper questions. Like, if you are unhappy and you went through the process of going and interviewing someplace else, you should really examine deeply why you did that. What are the issues at this current company? Very seldom when I ask people those deep questions are like, money's the only thing that's going to solve this problem. I love my boss. I love my clients. Everything's wonderful. I just wish they paid me more. That's never, ever the answer. it can work, I suppose, but it's a gamble. You never know if they're going to just accept your resignation or not.
And a friend just had this scenario happen, so I thought this would be a good question. What if you're offered a new job, maybe for a higher salary? But you're offered also a lower title than you had at your previous job. You know, when we talk about the things that maybe that matter more or equivalent to your salary, where does title kind of fit in? Do you go with something that's lower title, or, you know, how do you rationalize that one?
Okay, so there's two things here. So title in corporations is tied to benefits and perks often. So certain bands will get more PTO or they'll get more things. That's number one. But number two, this is really important. Your title as assistant manager at this one big company could mean nothing to the same company in the same industry. Their titles just don't match up. One of the things I learned as a recruiter really quickly was, like, I'd be like recruiting, you know, an accountant level two person at, you know, one of the big four companies. And then they were looking to go in. And I'm like, what I had to realize really quickly is when I was calling people and looking at their resumes is that titles mean nothing. You have to talk to someone, figure out what they're doing, because every company has different titles and different levels. The way it matters, though, in a job negotiation and a salary negotiation is that titles are tied to benefits at organizations. If you're tied up on your title, if you want a vice president, if you want an officer title, for example, because you have one at your current company, but the other company, you're not an officer yet, that's something entirely different. Number one, it goes back to, it doesn't really mean anything. They're not all lined up. There's not some like dictionary that all the corporations are like, okay, if you're this level, we all have to be VP number two. That's not the way it works. So it is all very artificial. The way it matters, though, when it comes to negotiation is that it is tied to benefits. So in that case, if you want to make sure you get more PTO, and if they say they won't budge on salary, negotiate a better title. It's free for them to give you a better title, basically. It's an easy thing for them to give you. And PTO is easy for them to give you, too.
I like that. Mm-hmm. I like that. Right? Everybody could use more PTO. I think sometimes we think we can't negotiate these things. Like, whatever is written out, that's what's said. So I like that there's some freedom here to maneuver within some things, right?
Yeah, some of the most common things would be title, sign-on bonus, salary, and PTO. Tuition benefits, you can't really negotiate. Sometimes I've seen people get a few more benefits on that. And healthcare, you can't negotiate because that's the same for everyone. 401k contributions are the same for everyone. So those are the big ones that you can negotiate.
So I know you didn't just become an interview expert overnight. I'd love to hear a little bit about maybe some of your stories in your career when you were interviewing, and maybe you wish you would have had the information that you have now in that process.
Yeah, surely. I mean, I'm absolutely motivated and inspired by providing tools backed in research and science that I never had. Absolutely. Previously, I was a director of talent acquisition. I managed the entire recruiting process for an insurance brokerage, and I loved my job. I created intern programs. I hired 80% of the organization from mail clerks on up to executive vice presidents. I partnered with the C-suite on all of our recruiting strategies. I loved every single person I worked with. And I'm not just saying that. And I had a phenomenal boss. But I had this moment, I had this calling where I felt like I was getting a little bit of judgment fatigue, and I could have easily just stayed in that role. I could literally still be there. But I realized that I wanted to do something more. I wanted to teach people how to do this because I realized that hiring managers are never trained to do this, and job seekers were coming in unprepared. And I thought, I'm in a unique position. I really care about this, and I want both sides to be able to do this better, and I want to create tools backed in research and science. And that was sort of where it started. I started my business April 2011 is when I left my corporate job with no business plan, literally nothing other than just that I just told you. Like, I was like, I want to do this. And then very shortly after, the dean of the risk management department at Temple University called me because I had just hired all of my interns from his program for years. And he said, you know what they're doing right and wrong. Can you come in and teach them how to interview? And I was like, I'm a teacher? I don't know. Am I a teacher? I don't know about that. And I'm so glad I said yes to that consulting job. I ended up teaching there for 11 years. I've taught thousands of people how to interview. And I taught three-hour interview workshops a week. I reviewed thousands of resumes and conducted thousands of mock interviews that we would record and play back for the students. It was like getting a PhD in interviewing. And that's where I collected my research. I discovered interview styles. And then fast forward, this is something that I think will help everybody. I created a product, a website, I launched it. I went to the HR conferences. I was really getting it out there. And then 2020 happened. And I was like, dun, dun, dun. I had two small kids at the time and this burgeoning product that was, just about to pop. And then everything, of course, came to a standstill. And I thought to myself, well, I'm never going to have this much time again for the rest of my life. So I have always wanted to write a book. Now's the perfect time to do it. And I had the research and I had just finished like creating the product and the personality assessment and everything. So I was like, okay, I'm going to do it. And the book really came out of me effortlessly. I wrote my book in a couple weeks and then I had a book and I was like, how do I get a book deal? How do I sell a book? And I queried a bunch of literary agents and they all ignored me except one woman who said, I'll give you 5 minutes. And I talked to her and she said, you're brilliant. The book's great. It's a unique perspective on something that's been done before, but you don't have a platform. So until you get like 200 or 250,000 followers, you won't get a book deal. And I, at the time, that was like, that's like standing on the side of Mount Everest. Like, how the hell am I going to get 250,000 followers? Like, what? And I resisted, like all good advice, I resisted it for 9 months and just ignored it and wouldn't do it. I was like, I don't want to, I have kids and I have this business. Who wants to get on social media? And I don't want to film videos. And then I just had such a responsibility to my book, and I believed in this so much. And I really want people to understand how they interview so much that I was so dedicated to it. I was like, okay, I'm going to do it. And I started posting videos in last day of January, I think. And in 6 weeks, I had 233,000 followers. Well, I also have to say, you know, I had just taught people how to interview for 9 years. So, you know, one of my employees called me and said, what does it feel like to be an overnight success? And we laughed and laughed. And she was like, I know you've been doing this for 10 years. So basically, I had perfected all the things I had talked about in classrooms and with my students. And I had taught over 10,000 people how to interview at that point. So at this point, I was just doing it in front of a camera. So I practice what I preach, right? The practice truly does make perfect, and really perfecting that and sticking with something and being dedicated to understanding how you do something is all really important part of interviewing well, and obviously building a platform too.
I want to go back to the fact that right now we're in layoff culture, and I know a lot of people are really nervous about that. There's a lot of big companies, you know, Google, Etsy. I mean, every time I look at it, LinkedIn, there's another notice of a company getting laid off. And I think it, you know, it just makes people that work for corporate jobs nervous. They're not sure what's coming next. What if you're at a job right now, and let's say you're interviewing out there because you think maybe you might get laid off? What do you say about your corporate job? Do you need to disclose any of that information?
In the interview process, when they ask you, why are you looking for a job?
Yeah, in the interview process.
No, you don't have to disclose any of that. And universally, the answer is usually, I'm looking for a new opportunity. I'm looking for my next challenge.
Okay. So don't have any fear about if you think you're going to get laid off, just going out there and interviewing and, you know, taking whatever opportunity might come your way.
I think fear is a very good word here, because I think you have to take ownership of your career. And I think most corporate jobs are based in fear. And that's how managers manage you, this fear that they could take this job away from you because you need this job for money. It makes sense, right? I made a TikTok the other day about this, that there's only two ways to get away from this fear. You either become financially independent or have a side hustle or sock a ton of money away, which a lot of people do. But the easier option is to relate to your job differently and to become so good at your job that, yeah, if you get laid off, it doesn't matter. You know that you're going to get rehired. Or if something goes sideways at your organization that you don't like, you don't feel stuck there. This phenomenon of quiet quitting is just, to me, very disempowered, scared people. Like, I don't know anyone ambitious that's like, oh, I'm just going to quiet quit. No, it's not about the company. It's about me. It's about what I can do. And if I'm unhappy, I'm going to take my very valuable skill set to the competitor and make more money. It's less about what they are going to do. And you have to change the way you relate to it to, what do you want? What are you going to, you know, like, you're the valuable one. And I think when you start thinking about it that way, you react to it differently and you're not worried anymore. You know, you're valuable.
I love that, because I talk about that in relationship to money all the time, the reframing and the power that you actually have yourself to reframe in a situation, right? Because there's two ways we could look at things if we're in that particular situation. And so I love this position of empowering yourself, that you are actually the valuable asset, that the job is not actually the valuable asset. I just think that's, I don't know, it's, there's something about it that is just so refreshing.
A million percent, because people get locked into this, oh, I'm so worried about getting laid off, or I'm so worried about getting fired. Why? There are more companies out there. There are so many other jobs and other opportunities, but you won't see them if you're down here worried in your foxhole, clenching your fists, worried, worried, worried. If you're out there and looking at all these opportunities and keeping your resume up to date, and you know you're great at your job, I always find too that the people that are super nervous about getting laid off are the ones that know that they're not keeping up with what they should be doing. That they know on some level that like they'd be terrified if they had to go head to head with competition. If you're kicking ass in your job, you're not too worried about it. You're Usain Bolt. You're like, let's go, put me in a race. So like you have to ask yourself some deeper questions there about where that fear really comes from. Maybe you're unpacking some fear around money. That's this whole separate issue. But I find most of the time, if you're really worried about that, it's because you know you're terrified of getting out into the job market. So own that and update your resume and, you know, practice some interview skills and put yourself out there and go to networking events and always be building your network. I meet with people all the time who have gotten laid off and they have no network and they have no one to go to and they have no help because they've never invested time in any of those things. And that's what makes you feel stuck. I will never, ever, ever give my power to anyone else. Not a spouse, not a company, nothing. I don't ever want to be in a position where I'm like, oh, please don't leave me. Job, husband, whatever. No, thank you. I will be financially independent and I'm okay no matter what. That is a more empowering place to be financially independent rather than dependent on anyone for approval or money or whatever.
Honestly, I haven't interviewed for a job in years, but I'm telling you, I think everything that Anna talked about applies to any interview situation, a new job, a new client, you name it. And I secretly love that she debunked the myth at the top of the show about mirroring the person interviewing you. I have heard that advice forever, and it always seemed very bizarre and very outdated. Why not just be yourself with a few tools in your tool belt to help you ace the interview? If you want to grab a copy of Anna's new book, Interviewology, you can head to our website, interviewology.com, and be sure to follow her on TikTok and Instagram for so many more gems around interviewing. I will have the links to all of that in the show notes, as well as links to our episode guests who make this show possible. And just a reminder, if you are not on the wait list for the release of my course on F Your Money, you are going to want to grab a spot. You can go to etmpod.link/moneycourse. All right, I will see you back here, my friend, in a few days for a brand new episode.